This is the holy month of Ramadan for Muslims around the world. It's a time of fasting, prayer, and celebration. But in Gaza, with the Israeli-Hamas war in its fifth month and warnings of famine growing, many residents are too hungry and sick to experience Ramadan as they'd wish. Israel currently prohibits international journalists from entering the territory, so reporting on Palestinians in Gaza and the hardships they're facing is an ongoing challenge. But NPR's Leila Fadel has been finding ways to stay in touch. Today on The Sunday Story, my colleague and the host of NPR's Embedded podcast, Kelly McEvers, talks with Leila about two stories she's been following. One is about a Palestinian-American family who was visiting Gaza when the bombardment started and got stuck in the war. The other is about a college student in Gaza who's been sending Leila voice memos for months.
My cousin just went out this morning and he saw the troops from a distance and he told us how they looked. They've shot people who were headed from the north to the south, and it's really dangerous to move right now, and the bombs are just getting closer and louder.
Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Noom. Noom understands that not everyone is starting from the same place and takes that into account. With their first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, you can find 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Noom. Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out the Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
We're back with The Sunday Story. I'm handing it over now to Kelly McEvers. Kelly sat down with NPR's Leila Fadel, who's been documenting the experiences of Palestinians in Gaza.
Hey, Leila.
Hey, Kelly.
So the Israeli government does not allow international journalists to report in Gaza.
Right.
And for Palestinian journalists reporting there, it's incredibly dangerous. More than 85 Palestinian journalists have been killed since October 7th. But still, you've been finding ways to tell people's stories from Gaza.
Yeah.
One of them is a young woman. Her name is Shema Ahmed. She was 20 years old when she first started sending you voice messages over WhatsApp. That was in October, at the beginning of the Israeli bombardment of Gaza.
Hello, Leila. As you hear, the situation now may not be the best situation to record anything ever, but when I have service, hopefully these messages will get to you.
You've been documenting her experience over the last several months. Can you just tell me a little bit more about her?
Yeah, I mean, the way I found Shema was I was trying to find people in Gaza during the very first blackout. The telecommunications company had been struck, cell phone lines were down, and all of a sudden we had lost contact with Gaza. And through a nonprofit, I was connected to Shema. And when people were able to communicate again, Shema and I started talking. I would send her texts asking her what life was like before, what she was going through, what she was eating, how she was surviving, and she would talk to me about life.
The neighborhood I used to live in is in Shija'iyah. It is a place that is very close to the borders of Gaza. It is a very beautiful neighborhood.
She would record voice memos into her phone whenever something came to her, whenever something was happening around her, something occurred to her. And then I would receive them in batches whenever she got a moment of service. And at the end of October, she sends me this first batch of messages. And she talked a lot about her life before October 7th, the beautiful rose garden in her grandmother's house, the room she had just redecorated, saved up money with her sister and redecorated in their home with the help of their uncles who are carpenters. She talked about her university.
To put it simply, I really loved university. I loved the library. I befriended one of the librarians who was very kind to me and always gave me book recommendations, and I'd always give him some of my book recommendations. We just had an amazing relationship. And he also helped me in a lot of things.
What a beautiful nerd, I thought, when she was describing how much she loved her professors and she loved science and she loved the projects she was working on. She said, me and the other students thought we were going to change the world with these projects. Maybe we wouldn't, but that was what we thought.
And we had this goal that once we graduate, we have to at least put together a computer that we connected on our own. That was just something we had to do at some point.
And what's that sound in the background?
That's the drones. That's the constant soundtrack of this war, Israeli drones in the sky. So many of her voice notes came in with sounds like that, sounds that were much worse.
My cousin just went out this morning and he saw the troops from a distance and he told us how they looked. They've shot people who were headed from the north to the south. And it's really dangerous to move right now. And the bombs are just getting closer and louder.
So when I was messaging with her, she was still in the north of Gaza when the Israeli military had told civilians to move south because Israel said anybody left in the city would be treated as a combatant. And this mass displacement had happened that the world was watching with extreme concern, people getting killed by the Israeli military on that path, people walking, carrying everything they had. But Shemat and her family, they had nowhere to go. So they didn't make the move, and the war is just escalating around her.
Today, six tons of bombs, six rockets, each weighed one ton, were bombed on a single residential square, and those bombs were U.S. made.
She knows she's talking to an American journalist. She knows she's talking to an American audience.
It's really hard to see that people are aiding this violence, and it's really just so hard to live through. Oh my God. That is all I have to say.
I mean, I don't know if 20-year-old Shemat knows if each of those bombs was a ton. And I don't know if she knows if those specific bombs or missiles were U.S. made. But her point was there is a sizable amount of military aid, weapons, and support coming from the U.S. And she's asking why. At a time, people are questioning what many see as a disproportionate response to the attack on October 7th. And there are questions about whether war crimes are being committed with the level of civilians that are being killed. The fact that Israel isn't letting food and water and fuel and electricity into the strip, the number of children that are killed, buried, the number of people under the rubble, all of this is coming across in those first batches of messages that she's sending me. And then, on October 31st, around 3 p.m., Shemat goes silent.
So at that point in the conflict, the Israeli military had basically ordered half the population of northern Gaza to evacuate and head south, as you said. And families would pack like 10, 12 people into a car, you know, navigate these bombed-out roads. So did she join that big move south?
I mean, I didn't know anything. I didn't know if they had made that move. Frankly, I wasn't sure she was alive at all. And then finally, one morning, she resurfaced. And I got a voice memo from her.
Hello, Layla. How are you? I hope you're doing well. Thank you so much for sending all the messages to confirm that I'm still okay and for sending me news and updates. Thank you so much.
The temporary ceasefire at the end of November, in which there was a hostage exchange deal and there were several days without attacks, had gone into effect. And so there weren't the sound of bombs, there weren't the sound of drones, but you could hear that she was getting tired.
If I wanted to explain what was going on the past few weeks, it's really hard to. It's like, I feel like big parts of my life, bits of my life, have been fading away as every day passed.
At this point, she's moved a little further south to Nosairat. She was staying in a 3-bedroom apartment with close to 100 people in it.
Every corner had people sitting, kids screaming and crying, and people talking, noisy, 24/7. It's crazy.
And there were only 2 toilets for 100 people.
And that's just the worst thing for me. I hate not being able to use the toilet properly, not being able to wash myself properly, and being smelly. I just hate that. And I'm a clean freak. That's how I am, usually.
Can you imagine not just not having running water, but nowhere to clean yourself up as a woman who has a period? She also, in those moments, would tell me the things that she was dreaming about.
Every night as I go to sleep, my dream is just me in my room with my sister watching a TV show with a bowl full of food and chicken that we haven't eaten for the longest time ever. You know, just relaxing with my family after having had a bath. And, you know, having dived in a bathtub full of hot, boiling water, that is just a dream that I really wish could come true.
There's so much that's in there, right? The unsaid there. The food that can't come in, so she's not eating. The hot bath, the hot shower, all things you can't have in this moment.
So you were getting these messages from Shema during the temporary ceasefire, which lasted about a week, and then ended on December 1st. And we know that Nusayrat, the area where she was hit pretty hard after that. Were you able to get in touch with her?
So at this point, as soon as I heard hostilities had resumed, that the Israeli bombardments had started again, I messaged her saying, are you okay? Are there any attacks in your neighborhood? Is there any fighting? And she sent me a long message that started with, yes, it's true.
It is continuous. It seems like we might have to evacuate again. But I don't think we're moving this time because we've had enough. Seriously, we've had enough. That's it. We have no place to go. It's packed everywhere. We're either going to die being shot or hungry. So, you know, it's better to die where we are.
And then I didn't hear from her again. And I kept thinking, okay, when is she going to get in touch? How do I get in touch with her? What's happened? And then finally, at the beginning of February, a new batch of voice memos.
We're about to move. I'm by the window just to record this. My parents are running around. My uncles and aunts are running around.
They're from the weeks that she wasn't in touch with me. She was recording for the day that she got cell data and was able to send them. And remember, she's not a journalist. She's documenting what she's going through for the world as she's going through it. The first one describes a day in early January where she's being displaced again.
It's already been 90 days before. It's not something easy. It's not something easy to handle. I have no idea if this is ever going to get to you because the place we're about to move to this time, would be a complete isolation.
She was on her way to the camps in Deir el-Balah, which is a refugee camp in central Gaza. And remember, really much of Gaza are refugee camps from 1948 when Israel was created and when Palestinians describe what they call the Nakba, the catastrophe, their mass displacement. Hundreds of thousands of people forcibly, sometimes violently displaced. And Deir el-Balah was a place that became a refugee camp in 1948 that started with tents, became hardened apartment buildings, and now is back to tents. So the historical echoes are everywhere, in everything she says that day.
Right now we're walking, I just wanted to record. We're basically running away. And just as a note, this is the 7th place. God, this is the 7th place we're evacuating to. We're the 8th? I seriously lost count.
This is the 7th place we're evacuating to, she's saying, or the 8th. She doesn't even know.
She doesn't even know. That's how many times. That's how many times. And around her, everybody's walking too.
Not as I'm walking, nobody's laughing. Everybody has a grim face on after they have been kicked out of their houses, kicked out of everywhere they could evacuate to, ended up on the streets in camps. Hopefully this is over in a few points in Gaza. Get their payback for what they've experienced and what they've lost. And nothing, nothing can ever pay back what we've seen and the horrors we've been through.
Wow, her voice sounds so different from those first voice memos she sent you.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed. It's hardened, Kelly. That's when I get afraid, because when people are in so much pain, going through so much trauma, they do want revenge. I remember that after October 7th, I was talking to a young man from the Kibbutz Be'eri who told me, "I don't care what happens to the people of Gaza. Shoot them all." And it wasn't because he's a bad person. He was a traumatized, angry, scared person who was hurt because about 100 people in his community were killed. And now listening to Shaymet, and she's talking about payback, and that's the cycle. You know, you're hearing it happen because people are human.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've met people who say, "I know that I've been hurt," but they're opposed to this level of the Israeli government retaliation. For example, I met a person whose brother was killed in the October 7th attack who said, "I know my brother's killed, but this bombardment won't make me safer. If you go kill Palestinian civilians, it won't make me safer. We have to solve it in a different way." But that is not the common reaction of a person who's been through something like this.
What about Shema? How is she doing? Is she okay?
Physically, she's okay. You know, she hasn't been hurt so far. She's lost her grandmother, her two uncles, professors, friends. She knows her university is gone. Her neighborhood on the border with southern Israel, Shejaiya, is gone. Her house is gone. She's in this refugee camp, and she's living a life that you shouldn't be living in 2024. No gas. People are cooking over an open fire. They're constantly looking for food, for water. And a reminder here, this is a man-made humanitarian disaster. You know, we're just a few months in and people are on the brink of famine. The UN just put out a report saying 10 children in Gaza have died from starvation or dehydration, including a baby that we reported about here on NPR. Shemat said the camp is really crowded. It's cold. People are sleeping in poorly insulated tents. And she and everyone there are digging out their own toilets in the ground. And I think the hardest message was when she sent me a message asking me, like, "Do you know about people who would sponsor students from Gaza? Because I need to go somewhere else."
It's pretty hard to see a future here, especially not being able to get access to education. I'm so passionate about learning. It's just what defines me in some ways.
Recently, she said she's even abandoned that. They're just finding a way to get out of Gaza, and that can cost a lot of money to try to get on that list to cross into Egypt.
Although, if Gaza was the same as it used to be, I would never. All the people I love are here, all my friends are here. But at the same time, it's the only choice I have, basically.
She's realizing there's no future for her in this place that she described with such love in those early days, and probably would still describe with love, but she knows there's nothing to go back to.
After the break, Layla will talk about how this conflict is affecting one Palestinian family who lives here in the U.S.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mattress Firm. To feel energized this spring, you need quality sleep. To achieve quality sleep, you need the right mattress. Mattress Firm will help you find the right bed to improve your sleep with their wide selection of quality mattresses at every price. Plus, if you see a lower price, Mattress Firm will match it. The right mattress matters, and Mattress Firm will find yours during the Friends and Family Sale. Shop in-store or online at mattressfirm.com. Restrictions apply.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Earlier this year, unsigned musicians from around the country submitted their original songs for the 10th annual Tiny Desk Contest. The panel of judges are hard at work picking standout entries, and you can follow along and choose your favorite videos as well. The winner gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert, then headline a tour with NPR Music this summer. Want to come along for the ride? Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to learn more, then check out the Venture X card from presenting sponsor Capital One. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
Okay, we are back with NPR's Layla Fadel. During this conflict, Layla, you've also been reporting on Palestinians who live outside of Gaza. You spent time staying in touch with a couple, Wafa Abu Zayda and Aboud Okal. They have a 2-year-old son. They live in Massachusetts. But they were actually visiting Gaza when the bombardment started. So how did you meet them?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was, you know, we were doing a lot of stories about Israeli Americans and other dual nationals who were feeling unsafe in Israel and they wanted to get home. And there were all these efforts to help people get out of Israel. And so I started to wonder about, what about dual nationals in Gaza? What about Americans in Gaza? What is being done to help them? And that's how I ended up getting in touch with Wafa and Aboud through a colleague here at NPR. And they hadn't been to Gaza, where their family lives, in years. And they had wanted the family to meet Yusuf, their baby. So Wafa and Aboud took a quick vacation. Well, they thought it was going to be a quick vacation. And then they find themselves with their child in Gaza when the war breaks out.
You know what's the hardest feeling? The hardest feeling ever is to hide your fear and show the opposite just to keep my son positive and full of energy because he doesn't understand anything. He thinks this is a fireworks. Okay, mommy, clap, clap. This is a fireworks. But sometimes he will jump, like he will like be like scared and freaking out if I'm not next to him.
This is the first time I ever spoke to Wafa, and this was after them for days and days trying to get help, calling the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, calling the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, being told really nothing, getting no information. There was no way to get out. The borders are sealed, remember. Nothing is coming in or out, not just people, but anything else, not fuel, not food, nothing. And so they start going public. They start talking to the press because they don't know what else to do.
Nobody's helping. Everybody's talking to us, but nobody's helping.
I think of this all the time. I think about it all the time, about her on our airwaves talking to millions of Americans.
Please, please save us.
What happened next? Like, How did they get out?
Yeah, so for 29 days, they were trapped in Gaza. And then one day, Aboud said to me that their name showed up on the list of people that are approved by Israel and Egypt to leave via the Rafah crossing, the border between the south of Gaza and of Egypt. And they got out. They got out, they went to Egypt, and finally got back to Massachusetts. And then I got to talk to them again at home with Yusuf safe.
Is this Yusuf?
This is Yusuf. Yusuf.
Hi, Yusuf.
Yusuf.
Hi.
I asked her like how he was doing, because I know he's too little to understand, but I always am curious about how little kids like that internalize such trauma.
Does he know he's safe?
I don't know if he knows that or not, but I think he knows we're back home, because he started to go around all his favorite places at the house and his room. And I think he knows we're back.
And what about Wafa and Aboud? How are they doing?
I mean, even the decision to leave was very hard for them because they had left their parents at that point behind and other extended family, siblings. And so they had a lot of survivor's guilt. Like, why am I okay? How come I got to cross the gate?
I think we were supposed to be extremely happy when we crossed into Egypt. Yet I think Wafa and I, for the first 2 hours of that drive, were just in tears, because you look back and you think about the people you left behind. Even those family members that you were not close with or you didn't know, you became extremely close with, because you were facing moments where you thought you all were going to die together. So I think when Wafa and I got to Cairo, we both had the same feeling. We took showers back to back, and we both cried in the shower, because we haven't taken a shower for weeks, and we know our parents still can't take a shower.
What does he know about his family now? How are they? Are they okay?
At this point, when I spoke to Wafa and Aboud, Wafa was checking on her family constantly. They had gotten out of Gaza just after her, and so she knew that they were safe. Aboud's parents were refusing to leave because his siblings were still there and their grandkids, but they did just get out. Aboud said, though, he can't always get in touch with his family that's still there, his siblings, because of the comms blackouts. And he says in some ways, being on the outside, it's harder because you're not there to know that they're safe. And so you're just guessing like the rest of the world.
We hear of bombings in X neighborhood, and you try to reach out to the people that you live in that neighborhood, and the calls won't go through, and then there's no way for you to confirm.
So he's not even sure how many family members they've lost.
How many American citizens are still in Gaza? Do we know?
It's really unclear at this point. When I was speaking to Wafa and Aboud at the beginning of all this, there were hundreds. We know that there are still Americans in Gaza, and there were a lot of people, Wafa and Aboud included, that felt that the American administration did not take the same type of care for American citizens in Gaza that they did for citizens in other places. And the question was raised, do American lives have less value in one place than they do in another? Publicly, the administration says, no, we work hard to get American citizens out no matter what. But a couple families sued the Biden administration over all of this. They said the government just didn't do what it was supposed to do. They didn't try hard enough to get U.S. citizens and relatives of U.S. citizens stuck in Gaza out of danger.
What about Wafa? Like, how has this experience affected her, or how does she talk about it?
I mean, when I spoke to them, I felt like they were still shell-shocked.
I feel right now, I don't wanna leave the house. I feel like I wanna stay here. I feel safe here.
I think they were still struggling to express what they've been through.
A lot of people, they were asking, like, would you like to go back to Gaza or Palestine? For now, I don't have an answer, but I don't know if I'm gonna go back with Yusuf again to Gaza. Because every moment, I imagined Yusuf under one of the houses or in the hospital, or or dying, or I don't know. I think with Yusuf, it's hard to do it again.
You know, something I was thinking about is they would sleep all on top of each other in Gaza so that if something happened, they would die all three. As Wefat put it, not one, not two, all three.
Listening to their story, I just can't help but think about how Palestinians from Gaza will never really be able to go back to the place they knew. I mean, what do you think will be their relationship to this place in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think about Yusuf, right? Like, Yusuf had never been to his parents' homeland before, and the first time he goes, it was war. And it's not even the original ancestral home, because Wafa and Abud's parents and grandparents were displaced from where they really are from. And Abud and Wafa grew up with multiple incidents of either violence or war or encounters with Israeli soldiers. Gaza had several conflicts that were considered extremely deadly before what we're seeing now. And so I thought about the generations and generations of pain, you know, decade after decade of living under occupation and the dehumanizing thing that it does to everybody involved, because the security of everyone in this strip of land is intrinsically linked. And if you live through something like what we're seeing right now, where according to the Gaza Health Ministry, more than 12,000 children have been killed, so they don't have a future. What is the future for the civilians, the young people, the children who do survive?
I mean, this makes me think about Shema. When's the last time you heard from her?
About a week ago. She posted a video to her Instagram from the refugee camp she's living in, so I knew she was still alive. And she sent me messages since. At this point, she doesn't know if she'll be able to get out of Gaza. And if she stays, she's not sure what her future will look like. You can hear her wondering about that in lots of the voice memos she sent me over the last 5 months.
You know, we're craving everything. We miss our life so bad. We miss our home so bad. We miss Gaza that we knew so bad. Because now everything we know is gone. And when we see the pictures and we see our memories and all the nice times we spent together, it feels like these times didn't exist in the first place. And even after this is over, we're going to go back to destruction. Total and complete destruction. Because it's just full of rubble on rubble, and that is all.
Does that mean permanent displacement for people like Shema? That's what they're asking. That's what they're wondering. Is there a possible peaceful solution with these decades and decades of pain and trauma and cycles of violence? All those questions are in my head right now, about the children of Gaza, about the children of Israelis, about the children of Palestinians.
Leila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was NPR's Embedded host Kelly McEvers talking to Leila Fadel. This episode was produced by the team at Embedded. It was edited by Luis Treyes and produced by Ariana Garib Lee with help from Abby Wendell. It was mastered by James Willits with help from Robert Rodriguez and fact-checked by Jane Gilvin. The Embedded team also includes Raina Cohen, Dan Gurma, Adelina Lancianese, Allison McAdam, and Nick Nevis. Liana Simstrom is the supervising producer, Katie Simon is the supervising editor, and Irene Noguchi is the executive producer. Thanks to our managing editor of Standards and Practices, Tony Cavan, and Johannes Durge for legal support. Special thanks also to Erica Aguilar, Anis Baba, Nina Kravinsky, Taylor Haney, Erizu Rizvani, Majda Al-Wahedi, and to our friends at NPR's International Desk, James Hyder and Dee Dee Skanky. That's it for today. Have a great rest of your weekend. Up First, we'll be back tomorrow with all the news you need to start your week.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Washington Wise. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how it may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/WashingtonWise.